Hey folks, if you're in Austin, Texas and you're looking for some live music, why not check out 2013-2014 Austin Chronicle Music Poll winner for Best All Ages Venue, Best Sounding Venue, and Best Venue, Strange Brew Lounge Side. Simply go to strangebrewloungeside.com, look on their calendar to find out what is going on. From Joe Ely to Christopher Cross, Steve Foltz to Renfro, to today's guest, Greasy Wheels, are all playing there. Go to Strange Brew Lounge Side for yourself and see what Austin's best venue has to offer. StrangeBrewLoungeside.com. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here?
I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you. You might be traveling to your Thanksgiving place right now. I'm wishing you all very safe travels, and I wish you a very happy Thanksgiving. Good luck with your family and everything. That sometimes can be kind of wacky. I have an amazing show for you guys today. Cleve Hattersley from Greasy Wheels is on the show today. Greasy Wheels are members of the Texas Music Hall of Fame. They're a band that is known as the Grateful Dead of Texas. They started out in the early 70s, in fact, in 1970. Cleve is just loaded with great stories. Anyway, they put out a couple records on London Records. They took a hiatus. Cleve moved to New York and ran the Lone Star Cafe up there, a very famous place. But while they were here in the 70s, the Greasy Wheels, they were like the house band of the Armadillo. Very famous scene. Opened or headlined for Willie Nelson, Bruce Springsteen, Flying Burrito Brothers, and tons of other people. And they hosted Tequila Wednesdays at Soap Creek Saloon for like 4 years, doing shows with like Stevie Ray Vaughan and all these kind of people there. Just amazing stories. He's got fantastic stories. He ran Kinky Friedman's campaigns. Cleve is an amazing guy. The Greasy Wheels took 23 or 24 years off, came back. Now they have a super group of great, great, great top-notch musicians. Some of my favorite people, some people that have been on the show. John Bush, Penny Joe Pulis, Brad Hauser, the amazing Matt Hubbard, along with Cleve Hattersley, Lissa Hattersley, and Sweet Mary Hattersley. All the Greasy Wheels. Great, great, great story. Amazing, amazing story. Great guy. And I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. All right? I hope you enjoy it as much as you enjoy Thanksgiving. Also, I want to let you know that they will be playing this Sunday, November 30th at 8 p.m. at the 1-to-1 bar. So you can go see the Greasy Wheels. The John Bush Experience will be going on before that at 6, I believe, is when it starts, or 6:30. So get out there. Have a night of it. Make a night of it. It's a night of great jams, great musicians, and great people all around. I will be there, okay? And speaking of 1-to-1 bar this week, Skyrocket will be playing there this Friday, November 28th, the day after Thanksgiving. We'll be playing there, so if you enjoy the Skyrocket, come out and see that. If you like, if you live in Houston and you like Skyrocket, we will be at the House of Blues Bronze Peacock Room on Saturday, November 29th. Come on out and see that. All right, getting ready to go practice some Mr. Rocket Baby stuff today. Got that show coming up Saturday, December 6th, also at the 1-to-1 bar. Man, a lot of 1-to-1 bar stuff for me this week. Got Skyrocket. I'm gonna go see the Greasy Wheels, and then I'm gonna play with Mr. Rocket Baby on the 6th. I like those people, Greg and Destiny Ware. Nice people, great place. Get out there and check it out. What else is going on with me? Mellow Thanksgiving. That's what I'm looking forward to. I'm gonna have a mellow Thanksgiving. Gonna chill out. Probably work on some Mr. Rocket Baby stuff. That's what I'm doing. I'm just kind of like cramming in, trying to learn all the words. I'm trying to do it without writing words down or reading words. So I'm just trying to memorize them. So when I go running, I listen to the record and the songs. Those of you who don't know, I was in a band, Mr. Rocket Baby, 20 years ago. We're doing a reunion show at the 1-to-1 bar on December 6th. Okay. Anyway, looking forward to that. It's been over 20 years. So this is like Greasy Wheels. We just took this time off, and now we're going to come back and play a show. I don't think we're going to hit it full on and make records again, but we're going to play this one show, and maybe people will enjoy it, and we'll enjoy it, I'm sure. It'll be fun, right? Mr. Rocket Baby. All right, let's talk to Cleve Hattersley from Greasy Wheels. If you are new to this show, this is episode 328 or 329. I'm not quite even sure what this is, but it's one of those episodes. There, I've got tons of episodes, tons of conversations with musicians, much like this one. I mean, obviously, every single one is different because of the people involved, but they're conversations that are similar to this, where you just talk about someone's life. Sit down, me and the person, or me and the band, and we shoot the shit. So if this is your first time listening to the show and you're coming to the show because you're a fan of Cleve or because you're a fan of the Greasy Wheels, go back and check out the other ones on the site on howdidigethere.podbean.com, and you can also subscribe on iTunes. We're available on Stitcher, which is an app you can find on your phone. It's a free app, and it streams over 5,000 podcasts and radio shows. So you can really get into it there. And we put out a new show every Tuesday and every Friday, two shows a week, new shows. I talk a little bit at the beginning of this, and then we get into our conversation with our guest, which today is the amazing Mr. Cleve Hattersley. What a great, I can't even tell you. This is a Thanksgiving gift for all of you to get to enjoy this man and our conversation. From the Greasy Wheels, Cleve Hattersley. Let's get down.
Does these political pieces that there's a little art, there's a little this and that, you know, there's paste-ons, there's all kinds of stuff. And that reminds me of him as well.
What's that called?
I have no, mixed media.
Mixed media.
That's all
that's
I know.
Yeah. I knew it was something with an M.
Right.
Yeah, Basquiat didn't have any political...
No, that's what I'm saying.
Bobby Lee is kind of a
Black Panther version of it, where he's got this anger, this deep, deep anger that, you know, comes out in all of it.
Where does he live?
He lives in Houston. Okay. In fact, he and his brother have been sort of political powers down there for the last maybe 25 or 30 years.
Really?
Uh-huh. And we got to know him when we were, you know, I ran Kinky's campaigns.
A couple of his
campaigns. Yeah, I started his gubernatorial campaign. I was kind of
As campaign manager?
Yeah, I started as campaign manager, but as a starter manager, because we had hired these two guys out of Minnesota who had gotten Jesse Ventura elected.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you remember, Kinky ran as an independent.
Right, and so did Jesse, right?
And Jesse had as well. And we thought we needed their expertise on positioning and getting money and all that stuff. It turned out they really didn't know Texas, and it didn't quite work. And then when Jesse showed up, here's the former governor. He shows up with a Fu Manchu with little bells on it and hair down his back, you know, to go to West Texas with us. And it was like, it was just a disaster.
Yeah, that is a disaster.
It didn't work very well. But then I managed his most recent campaign for ag commissioner, and that was pretty much my undoing.
Really?
Yeah. Well, the Democratic...
That's one of my fantasy jobs.
What's that?
Campaign man. I mean, I don't really know exactly.
Well, it's a great fun. I wasn't the official campaign manager. I was senior advisor. We brought in a gal named Rania Batrice to take the title, just so that we could put her out there doing the interviews and stuff.
Right.
But the Democratic Party had never forgiven Kinky for that gubernatorial run when he was an independent. They felt that he helped defeat Chris Bell.
Oh, really?
And they started on the last week before the primary, they started running negative ads and robocalls, our own party against Kinky. And we won, and we got into the runoff, but we couldn't overcome it, and they would never take it back, and they just kept sort of pummeling Kinky, and there were sort of these racist tones, you know, Kinky's a racist, he's always been very, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen or heard a Kinky show.
Very
up front.
Yeah.
So we got killed in the runoff, but we had a good time. It is fun.
Yeah.
It is fun. It's very...
strategizing is what seems...
Yeah, and seems what you exciting. Have to... Yeah, you have to position. And Kinky was positioned where We could very easily have crossed the aisle. He got 560,000 votes in the gubernatorial race.
Really? Jesus, that is awesome.
Before that, we had 130,000 signatures to get him on the ballot. Right? And those were all volunteers. We did raise $6 million.
Wow.
And we spent it all.
Yeah.
Because I think Rick Perry had $30 million at that point or something like that. But it's fun. It is.
How, were you involved in anything in the last election, in this past last couple
this
weeks?
This last one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This last one. This is one we
oh,
ran.
Oh, this is the one that you ran the ad.
He ran for ag commissioner for the second time. The first time he had hired Rania last minute, and I hadn't come into it. Kinky and I are sort of, we've been together 40 years, but it's always like divorce, and then we get back together, and then divorce, you know, because we're very willful. We're both Jews.
Yeah.
But I had come back for this campaign, and we created a legalize it campaign, full production of hemp campaign. We had dreamed up the idea of school gardens and expanding school gardens into the community, where family gardens would then start supplying organic foods along with what the children grew, so that we could have, you know, do what HEB is actually doing, providing organic good food for good prices.
Yeah.
Right. And we had a really good platform, but the Democrats just didn't get it, and I think they paid for it.
Yeah,
they paid for it.
It's kind of a slaughter.
They didn't have any kind of real platform. Wendy remained insulated by about four people. The Engel brothers and a couple other guys kept her kind of disjointed from everything.
Yeah, I watched a debate. I was just not
unimpressed.
I was totally unimpressed.
Right, exactly. And she's really not she's a good person with good ideas, but they never brought great ideas to the campaign. My opinion is that if you've been out of power for as long as the Democratic Party is, for the party to achieve any success, it has to be radically and sort of defiantly progressive and come up with really, really big ideas.
Yeah.
I mean, you can talk about education, and it is important.
Yeah.
And you can talk about what she was bringing up, women's rights, extremely important.
Yeah.
But they're not election winners.
Right.
And they never will be. Not in Texas, anyway. You know? So what you do is you dream up stuff that Republicans and Democrats both like.
Right.
The farmers loved Kinky's plans. Kinky, help us get hemp.
Yeah.
The cotton's killing us.
Yeah.
You know? So.
Is there any way that you can do stuff after the election happens where you can still kind of try and,
well,
I mean, is there a way for Kinky Kinky's movement to keep moving ideologically?
Actually, that's exactly what's been happening in a funny way. And Kinky and I are old. I mean, Kinky's 69, I'm 67. So how many more years you want to do it? It takes a lot of energy.
Yeah.
He's actually positioned himself perfectly for the next cycle.
Really?
If he chooses to do so, because we were the only ones that had good ideas, and everybody knew it, even the party knew it. We were the only ones that connected with the county parties. We went into the different counties like Travis County and Harris County and Tarrant County, and got to know those people. And those are the people that are going to be running the next cycle.
Right.
So it ain't dead.
No. Well, that's good. Dead. So when did you guys met 40 years ago?
We met in Texas, really.
Yeah. Where are you from?
Rochester, New York, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. I came down in 70, 69. And Kinky and I met at the Soap Creek Saloon, the original Soap Creek Saloon. And his backup band was Paul Ray and the Cobras with Stevie Ray Vaughan. I couldn't fucking believe it. I've been hearing about this guy, and then his backup band is the Cobras.
Yeah.
And we liked each other, and then I ran the Lone Star Cafe in New York for quite a few years when I kind of put the band on hiatus. And he played every Sunday night at the Lone Star Cafe.
Okay.
And every Sunday night became kind of like the mission was to keep Kinky focused and keep him on stage. Because there was always a round delay of great guests. You know, Belushi would be in one night, and Robin Williams would be in one night, and performing with Kinky, you know, on the stage.
Like improv?
Yeah. One of the greatest I ever saw was Don Imus and Robin Williams doing dueling reverends after they had both done like about 6 lines of cocaine. It was absolutely insane. It was just insane. Because Imus, in those days, I don't know if you're familiar with Don Imus.
I'm also familiar with Imus's reverence for Kinky.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
A lot of Texas artists.
Oh, yeah,
he
yeah.
He loves a lot of Texas singer songwriters.
Imus was a regular at the Lone Star.
Very supportive.
Yeah, and that's what the Lone Star was about. And that's why Mort, the owner, hired me in when I put the band on hold for 23 years. Was that I knew the Texas scene, and he was limited in his understanding of it. And he would ask me every couple of months, well, what do you think's happening in Texas now? And I'd say, well, let's try some Zydeco now.
Yeah.
You know, or the rhythm and blues, you got to beef that up, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But Kinky could play every Sunday. He was the only act that could play every week. Every other act had to play twice a year, Levon, Dr. John, anybody else. But the Jews come out on Sunday night for Kinky. They just did.
Yeah.
And so when, say, Robin would be on stage, the next trick was finding Kinky to get him back on stage.
Oh.
He'd be in some corner of the, you know, yeah. the club doing whatever. And that sort of developed into protecting Kinky and road managing Kinky, all that kind of stuff. And it just sort of...
And that was in the 80s?
That was the 70s.
70s.
Yeah,
okay.
At the end of the 70s, yeah. 78, 79.
Okay, so let's go back. You're from Rochester, New York.
Rochester, New York. Yeah.
And so what was the... Somebody told you to move to Austin.
Well,
you?
I'd been working at the Fillmore East in New York.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I worked at the Fillmore.
What were you doing there?
I was the stage door guy. You had to get past me to get on stage, to get to the stage.
And were you already playing and like writing songs
and
stuff?
No, I wasn't playing music. I hadn't learned how to play guitar even. I was about 19 or something, and... We just knew some people, and half of my little town in upstate New York, I had moved south of Rochester to a little town, and about half of that town ended up working at the Fillmore. And everybody was saying, man, it's time to go to California, and I went out there in 67,
you applied for a transfer with Bill Graham to the Fillmore?
Yeah, I did. I actually did? Yeah, I did.
I
went out
there
and sat in front of Bill and said, Bill, can I work here right now? And he said, man, I don't have any fucking jobs right now. I ended up getting a job at the post office, which was the first hippie gig ever, where hippies could actually work a gig.
Oh, really? They didn't make you cut your hair or anything?
No. They paid really well, too.
You could wear shorts in the summer.
But anyway, I met a whole lot of Texans out there.
Yeah.
And you discovered that New Yorkers and Texans had the same understanding of bigness, of grandness.
Yeah.
You know, big New York, big Texas.
Yeah.
In a completely disjointed and different way, but acceptable to each other. So we would have these sessions, and in the sessions, we'd just sitting around smoking dope or eating Thanksgiving dinner or whatever, and the Texans could sit there for 4 hours without saying a fucking word. We New Yorkers couldn't stop talking,
right.
You know. That's but it kind of worked out. And among those people, be like Rocky Erickson hung out with us when he was just going off the map, and all these Texas women were just hot. They were just so hot, and one of them got me a ticket, bought me a ticket through a pot dealer to come down here. And the hate was dying by 68 anyway.
Yeah, it was all 69. Gross.
Yeah, and it was getting bad.
Yeah.
I actually moved to the Fillmore area after that. But I got down here, it was 107 fucking degrees. I had never experienced that. But when I got to this place on Blanco Street, it used to be a house at 905 Blanco. 107 degrees, I'm just absolutely drenched already by the time the cab gets, a $2 cab ride from the airport over there. And Phyllis, one of the girls, comes bouncing out in her topless dancer outfit with a beer in her hand. The cab driver, this about 300-pound black man, just about has a heart attack. And I'm thinking, I'm fucking home, man.
Yeah, this is...
That was it. Are you going to leave? I don't think so.
No way. Was she a professional dancer?
She danced at a place at that time called the Body Shop.
Wow, they even had cheesy names back then.
Uh-huh. And it's still a topless joint. It's a Spanish catering one up near 38th Street. And it's right on the highway.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like Boca Chica or something. Something Chica. Bonita. Chica Bonita.
Yeah, there you go.
That used to be the
Chica
Body
Bonita.
Shop.
Okay.
And in those days, they wore pasties.
Right.
But she came bounding out with her little bottom on and pasties.
Wow. And so what were you going to do here? What was your
plan? I was going to be a pot dealer, and okay. I was.
Right.
I smuggled pot from here to New York.
Okay. What was that like back then?
In those, there was no security thing to go through. You just took your bags in and checked them in and got on the fucking plane. And you walked out on the tarmac instead of having any entry, you know.
Yeah.
And we would put 50 pounds in a trunk and just put a bunch of baby powder in it and just take it. But
what would you, like, you put a bunch of baby powder, like, loose or in?
We would have sealed bags of pot. Okay. You know, very tightly sealed, double sealed with very heavy plastic.
Okay.
I mean, it's not like you still couldn't smell it, but nobody understood it then. Nobody knew what it was.
Right.
But one guy caught me on the third time through, a Braniff employee, just noticed that I'd been through too many times, and they opened my bag, and it was a long story. Made the front page.
Yeah.
Did a year in prison.
That's insane.
Yeah.
And what I mean, how did you get out? I mean, when there were people at that time, like even like Rocky, didn't Rocky?
They gave me 7 years, but Ronnie Earle, who became our DA here for 25 years, at that time he was a state senator. And I had been, the greasy wheels formed between the time I got busted and the end of my appeal, which was a 2.5 year period.
Okay.
And we would play parties for Ann Richards' gang and Ronnie's gang. I mean, all the, you know, we hung out with all these people. And Ronnie became the guy who took the new small amount marijuana bill in 1973 over to the governor to sign in for small amount, you know, like 4 ounces became a misdemeanor at that point.
Right.
And he and his pal, Russ Million, he was the guy that was his assistant at the time. Russ told me this 25 years later, he gave me the whole story. I hadn't heard it until then. They were over there. They got there about 2 in the afternoon. And they started working through the bill. And every hour or so, they'd stand up and say, oh, is that it? And they'd say, no, we got more shit to go through. Because these are all long, detailed things you have to do. And they were there till midnight. And at midnight, Governor Dolph Briscoe stood up and said, all right, that's it. We're done here. If there's one more fucking thing, I'm going to shit can the whole bill. You're going to have to start over again. And Ronnie had the temerity to say, no, we want you to let this guy out. And the governor signed my commutation paper, and I got out 11 days later.
Rock star shit.
I guess so, yeah. We had free greasy T-shirts. You know, it was cool stuff.
What was that scene like here then? I mean, I've heard it from different angles.
Yeah.
But it seems like you guys were the house band of the Armadillo, although there are a lot of bands that are affiliating themselves in certain ways under that, almost that same moniker.
You guys
are the guys.
Yeah, we played there more than any other band.
Yeah.
Yeah. And anytime, pretty much anybody that they didn't trust as a headliner coming through, they would ask us if we worked a deal with them where we could make good money on full houses of our own. And then we would do opening slots for $100 or a couple hundred bucks just so that they could bring in Bruce Springsteen.
That's a lot of money then.
It was okay. It was enough for us to say, sure, as long as they gave us our nachos. You know, they gave us free nachos at the end of the show, and that was fine. But we did that for Willie Nelson's first show. I don't know if you saw Corcoran's piece where he listed the top 25.
It was
the most influential show in his mind, and that was because we could fill the house for Willie, and then for Bruce Springsteen, and several other acts like that. Commander Cody's first time through, Asleep at the Wheel's first time. We were the ones that brought the hippie crazies, you know.
I went into this wormhole. I was watching these like black and white videos. It seemed like they're
that
like
is wormhole camera,
three camera, or at least two camera shoots.
They did a lot of adventurous stuff, and it was all terrible quality. The sound, Eddie Wilson's got tons of that stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, back then,
it was awesome. I never saw it until, you know, maybe, again, 30 years later, because, you know.
It disappears.
Yeah, it just sort of went into vaults or something, And Eddie has all that stuff, and I keep, every now and then, I'll see one appears on YouTube of us, and I don't know where it came from. I don't really care. It's fine. You know, it's at my age, anything you get on the net, it's good.
Yeah, well, I ended up seeing I didn't see you guys on there. I didn't watch the whole thing. It was like six parts or something, but there was like this USA show when I was a kid called Night Flight, and it was like a goodbye to the Armadillo.
Oh, really?
They had like Jerry Jeff kind of says this thing at the beginning, and they had this guy, Commander Cody, who I knew his name
from
being a kid, you know, living in Houston, coming up here. You know, my mom used to go to the Armadillo and stuff in the '70s, and I would hang out with this guy that would watch. We'd watch these jazz shows on on the Access channels here. Anyway, I couldn't believe sort of like the gravity of how much, like what else of a scene was going on here? Because it was so huge. It was like the sun in the scene here, right? The Armadillo?
No, actually, it was kind of the opposite in a way. I mean, it was something that we watched explode around us. But it was really, when I got here, it was sort of a cadre of people. I remember sitting around smoking joints saying, man, I wonder how many people are actually smoking joints around the country right now. And our guess was maybe 100,000. You know, that's how small everything was.
Yeah.
And for me, it was always scary to have come from the north, a very liberal family, you know, college teacher, father, that kind of stuff, to come down into this place where everything outside of Austin was so regressive and repressive that any time a pickup pulled up next to me, I thought I could die any minute. And that was really a fear that was sort of all the time. But it just seemed that once the Armadillo started, you know, build it and they will come.
Yeah.
And that's what happened. You know, I still felt that there's still a whole lot of people with whom I communicate on Facebook, because we reattached via Facebook, that are just from that sort of core, like the Michael Priests and the Jim Franklins as artists, mm-hmm. and the Ray Bensons and, you know, the, mm-hmm. the musicians and so on. And Alvin Crow was real a part of that scene as well.
Yeah, he was on that special too.
Yeah, yeah. And Alvin was he played the other Bruce Springsteen show. Yeah, he could also draw a crowd.
So what but was that like Bruce Springsteen show? Was it like postcards from Asbury Park or whatever? Greetings from Asbury Park?
Well, it was the earliest stuff.
That's his first record, right?
Yeah, and we saw a part, you know, we were oblique in a lot of ways. We didn't really see everybody, you know. We did a show and we went out and got high and hung out, you know. We would see some guy, but I remember him being really, really dramatic and just too fucking good.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole band was really tight, really tight. And when I went to prison, somebody bought me a subscription to Cream magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And I got one issue before the prison official said, you can't have this. And in that issue, on one page, there's a full article about Bruce Springsteen. And on the next page is a full article about us. And I think that may have been the high point in my fucking career right there.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That is awesome. Who wrote the article? Do you remember? What's his name? The Lester Bangs guy? Because I know he lived here for a while.
It might have been. You know, again, we were oblique and oblivious to so much of that shit, you know. The only writer we knew was the old guy, Townsend Miller. He was an old guy that worked for the Statesman.
Mm-hmm.
And he was already in his 60s, I think, when he was hanging out then. But he was hip to what was going on.
Yeah.
And he promoted us just relentlessly. He constant great pieces and, you know.
Yeah. Isn't it this weird? People in their 60s then are so much different than people in their 60s now.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding.
You know what I mean?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
I'm 46, and people that were 46 when I was a kid were fucking old.
It's a very different
thing. You know what I mean?
It's a very different thing.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably been that time immemorial, generation to generation, but we felt it in a really exploding society. You know, where not only is population exploding, but all the advantages of society up to internet and things like that.
Right, right.
And I think that... And having even health as an issue wasn't part of our growing up. You weren't thinking. I mean, you'd go to the gym as far as school, you know, gym class.
Right.
But our football players didn't look like big giant mountains.
They smoked cigarettes too.
Yeah, yeah, and drank beers and shit.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
Art Donovan, the great player for the Baltimore Colts, was just insanely funny about that. You know, drinking beer and smoking cigarettes and going out and playing a game and being so winded that he had to go smoke another cigarette to go play the second half. Yeah. So we didn't, you know, those things weren't thought of. And I don't know. The only thing that I worry about is I read a piece recently about the disadvantages of instant communication. And it's worried me for a long time because I think I was feeling it already, where everything is so readily and easily available that we're losing curiosity. We're losing our own thought processes in the process.
Yeah.
But I'm going to be here maybe 15 years good, so I don't care. I'm just going to live it and enjoy the good stuff that you get from the internet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You still like playing a lot?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. Oh, it looks like you do. I watched some recent videos too.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I don't know if you
got a cool fucking band too.
It's a good band right now. It's a good band. Yeah. And it's really kind of a return to sort of the original thing of a lot more jamming, a lot more keeping loose arrangements so that we can let people, you know, fill them, you know, go Matt, do it, you know, go Mary, do it.
Yeah.
And the one we're working on right now is the first one that's all Brad Houser on bass and awesome. All Matt Hubbard on, you know, his
How's
stuff.
Brad's finger?
He's doing great.
Good.
He's doing great.
He was like playing like the next day, right?
Yeah. He's fucking amazing.
That's
fucking
a player. Amazing. I mean, that's what that guy is.
Yeah, and he's actually, he was worried most about the horn, but he's doing great on the horn, too.
Good.
And that's something we put on this record for the first time is horns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like, he and John are like from a class ahead of me. Maybe two classes ahead.
Yeah, I think,
you know,
John's
I mean?
52 in or something like that.
I really, like, they're guys that like were seniors when I was like a freshman or
something.
And I really look up to those guys. And anytime I get to play with them is like such a treat. I can only imagine having them in your band.
It's been, Jody Denberg pointed it out, I think, after the band had been together about 4 weeks. We hadn't done even a gig, and we were in the studio just doing a live thing with him. And he already knew, this is the best you've ever had. And I don't want to say that to denigrate any of the other players, because over the years we've had great
30-something players or something?
23 showed up for the when we were inducted in the Austin Music Hall of Fame. And only John Mambo Trainer, who was dead by then, couldn't make it. And Chris Layton, who was stuck on a plane. So there have been a lot of great players, but something about this combination of players.
Yeah.
With the fact that Bush and Houser had been playing together since they were kids.
They seem like part of that. And fucking Matt Hubbard seems like he was born to be.
He's now a member of Edie Raquel and New Bohemians. You know that, right?
No.
Yeah, he's been added to the band.
Well, that's good, man. Yeah. He has that spirit of that jamming. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not like kind of BS jamming. I don't know the music of Widespread Panic, but to me in my mind, that's too much jamming.
That's BS jamming.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's go back, because you were talking about the immediacy and the immediacy and not being able how in the hell did you guys in 1970, early 70s, get to London Records? Were you touring and you...
No,
or did that Cream article?
No, two guys came down from London because they'd heard about us.
Okay,
and maybe it was—I can't remember if we'd already been booked for the it was the first year of Austin City Limits. We were on the first year,
Okay. And
we may have been booked for that or not. But the phenomenon was happening. It was like, you know, the closest phenomena that I can think of over the last 20 years would probably be the Bob Schneider phenomena, where it just sort of exploded for Bob, you know what I mean? And that's what it was like. So people were hearing about it. And traveling, we did travel. We bought a fucking 49 flexible flyer bus and diesel bus and put an air conditioner on it. And we did travel, but mostly to New York. We never made it to the West Coast, but we'd do the Texas and, you know, Louisiana and Oklahoma areas. They figured it out, came down, and offered us a deal. And
was it hard for people to get in the rest of the South, though, because they were kind of a little too close-minded? Because even though you were playing traditional music,
We weren't playing traditional. That's sort of a misnomer in a way, yeah.
But you were using...
traditional instrumentation.
Yeah, when you... I mean, I saw you cover a song like... was it May the Circle Be Unbroken?
Well, yeah, we did stuff like that, sure. And we did I Never Cared for You, the Willie Nelson song.
So what you were where you were coming from was country music, hillbilly music. That's That was that's part
where
of your foundation.
Part of the band. That's
yes.
Where, no, not mine.
No.
That's part of the band. Okay. My foundation was always Hendrix and John Lennon and
so,
Dylan.
So maybe it was maybe a little too freaky to take that act to Mississippi.
Yeah, it was. We played Oxford a lot.
Okay.
It turned out Oxford, even back then, had the one government-sponsored pot farm at the University of Mississippi. It's still there.
For what? For research?
The research. And the mayor of Oxford had the best dope of anybody in the fucking state. So we could go to Oxford, do great gigs, get as high as we possibly could, and then go to New Orleans and enjoy ourselves. But London signed us up. Peter Hay was one of the two guys, and oddly enough, when we released our second record in this century, I found out that Peter was a record promo guy. So I hired him, and I continue to hire him as our record promo guy. So when we release, I take all the money I make from Kinky, and I put it into paying for a decent release. I pay him a few $1,000s. We do a national release. We do everything we can, you know, within our budget to promote it, and sort of keeps us going.
You should have a radio. Do you have a radio show?
No. Used to.
Used to.
I did a Steamboat.
Awesome voice.
I did a fucking Steamboat show.
Really?
Yeah.
When?
Right before Danny came in, John Logan at Z102 and I hosted a.
I remember Z102.
For a little while, John tried to make it a cool station. He did his best. He really did. And the radio show was hilarious. We were funny as shit. We were having Sugar's dancers come in and doing strip shows for the live audience. And it was pre-Howard Stern. I mean, this was already popping. But the station got real nervous about it because we just had no morals and we didn't, you know, I didn't care what I said, really. I mean, I didn't curse, but I mean, I had jokes about gay people and I had jokes about, you know, all kinds of stuff that was kind of Kinky-esque. So they canceled the show. And 2 weeks later, the program director was fired. Everybody was gone.
Oh, yeah.
John Logan went off somewhere, and that was the end of it.
So. Okay, so wait, let's go back. This record that you put out was a Just Love Them Old Greasy Wheels was the one that you put out on London?
That was the first one. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How was that received, and what did you guys do back
then?
We
sold about 25,000 copies.
1975?
In 70, yeah, I guess that's right. Okay. 75, yeah, 75. Yeah, we sold about 25,000 copies and just missed the charts. We tried to do a live record without being live. We went to the studio in the country in Bogalusa, and it was a brand new facility. And the company did give us good studios to work in. But we didn't know anything about translating what we were doing live. We didn't even know what we sounded like. I hadn't even really heard the other side of the stage. There were 8 of us, you know, 3 guitar players, and a mandolin and a fiddle. And, you know. And Riley Osborne came and played on it, too, so we had keyboards as well. It's a very, for me, hard to listen to record because of that. But, you know, it was us. On the second record, we went to Electric Ladyland in New York, and then we went out to the record plant in Sausalito. And then we did mixdown in the old CBS studios in New York, which is at that time was the greatest of all mixdown platforms. It was just fantastic. So they gave us all every advantage. We did a much cleaner, much purer studio-oriented album, and right after we finished recording it and they mastering it, they fired everybody on the staff at London Records and went a completely different direction.
That just happened. I mean, did that always happen?
Yeah.
To the whole, it happened in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s.
That was the sort of pro forma way to deal with an act and to deal with a company. If you weren't satisfied with the act, axe everybody that hired them, you know.
Yeah.
We were the only act actually produced by London America. They had the Stones on, you know, London product, but they weren't produced in London, America. And Al Green brought his product in on High Records.
Okay.
So, let
me ask you this: did you do when those records came out? Did you do any tours with anybody?
Yeah. We went up to New York and we did several summers going up to New York and playing like we'd do Lake Placid to make a lot of money because there was a place up there that paid us a ton of money. And then we did the bottom line for that one and, doing all the regular, this is a new band thing. We had a show. The first one for that first record was at the Bottom Line on a co-bill with Dr. Hook and the Medicine Show. Okay.
Awesome.
And we had never done a 45-minute set. We were a fucking jam band. Right? So I'm getting ready. I got three more songs on my list. And then the third one is the big finale. We do Orange Blossom Special, and we just drive the people out of their fucking minds. Yeah. Well, they tell me one more song, and I made the mistake of not picking it, to just going straight to it. And we did okay, but it wasn't what happened the next three nights when we did finish correctly, and the place went fucking bananas. So the industry people didn't see the bananas.
Yeah.
So I feel it's all Dr. Hook's fault. No. They were sweet guys.
They never sang you like on tour with like Black Sabbath or something?
That wasn't happening in those days. There were not a lot of packaged or prepackaged tours going on. A band went out and they did it. You know, when the Talking Heads came in, they just came in Talking Heads.
I watched a little bit of that 1979 show from the Armadillo.
Oh, they were fucking
Did you open
great.
For them then?
No, but we wanted
Somebody
to.
I know did.
I'm not sure. It might have been Balcony's
You watched
fault.
That show?
Oh, yeah, I've seen it, but it's been a long time. Yeah.
Man. Okay, so then you guys came back, and how long was it before you guys took your hiatus? And what did you do before you took that hiatus? Like, what did you guys do as a band?
We
put out those two records, and then nothing until 2001.
Yeah, what happened was after the final trip to New York, Tony Iroldi, great guitar player, does Django Reinhardt these days. He's a really terrific guitar player. Decided he couldn't travel anymore, and he was a major part of the sound because we kind of built this crazy sound around mixing Django and country and all this stuff.
And then your crazy influence.
Yeah, and then the band, a lot of the band members did not want to make the big trips anymore. They just wanted to tour Texas and do regional gigs, and that was just too hard to book consistently.
Okay, so you couldn't really make a living doing that?
No.
Okay.
No.
Dallas?
We would do Dallas, Houston, Waco gigs.
What were the venues? Just to like,
Dallas, we did Fanny Ann's.
I don't know this place.
That was a great joint. It was a lot of fun. Fanny Ann's.
Where was that?
There
wasn't like a Deep Ellum then.
No. It may have been called Deep Ellum to about four people, but you know, there was no neighborhood situation yet.
Okay,
no.
Okay.
It was near the Mockingbird area.
Okay.
Yeah. Houston, we started at Liberty Hall, which is a great small theater. Our best show there was, our favorite show was opening for Freddie Fender. Just before he started his first comeback with, you know, Many Teardrops and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Then we would play, there was the Austin Music Hall there and an Austin Music Hall here that Willie owned. And just all kinds of joints like that, you know.
Yeah.
You just never stop. You play every weekend. You played Beaumont. We played Tyler. We played Nacogdoches. But you can only play them X times a year, just like any act,
sure.
You know, and still make the dollars you need to make. So they left the band, and we brought in Chris Layton. It was his first full-time band gig. We hired him over Freddie Kirch, which still bothers Freddie to this day, I think. But Chris had this thing, you know, we just knew it, right?
Yeah.
And he brought in a bass player named Chip Dill, good bass player, and Vic Egli, a guitar player. And we did a couple years with these guys. And Chris came to us one evening and said, Cleve, I got to go play with Stevie Ray. And at the time, Stevie was sleeping on couches. And I said, Chris, you're making a big fucking mistake, pal.
Yeah.
And we still laugh at that, of course. I just got tired of switching. The original band had just sort of coagulated like a family. You know what I mean? And that I missed that already.
Now you're trying to fit these parts in.
Yeah, and I didn't want to keep fitting them in.
I know that exactly.
I just said, fuck it, and I called Mort up at the Lone Star in New York and said, I'm coming up, give me a job. And he did.
So far that's the most Jewish thing you've said in the interview so far. So I called Mort up in New York at the Lone Star and I said, hey, I'm coming up. Give me a job.
You know, here's a New York attitude. Recently, Mary and I were in New York and on vacation, and we went out to Brooklyn Heights where we lived, great four-story brownstone, and we were walking by it, and And the couple that lived there was walking out as we walked by, and we were standing there staring. I said, excuse us, don't mind us, we used to live here.
Right.
And they said, well, welcome home. And then we told this to a New Yorker friend, and she said, well, if you're a real New Yorker, yeah, you would have said, can we come in? Can we look?
Yeah.
And yeah, there's a lot of New Yorker in it.
Yeah. So well, so when you went up there to do the Lone Star, you didn't play at all?
Yes, we did.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. We formed a band called the Sweet Penetrators.
All right.
And it was strictly covers and rhythm and blues and slide guitar and
what
a little
kind of
bit
covers?
A little bit of, oh, we would do like Bo Diddley covers and okay. stuff like that.
Yeah.
And we were really pretty good. And the guy that played harmonica was this, he passed away a few months ago, Shredney Vollmer. Shredney, what a name. And Shredney ended up playing for years with Rick Danko and Levon. So we were all, you know, kind of. And we would get to open whatever shows we wanted since I booked a lot of the bands through Mark.
Oh, that's cool. Know?
And when Doug Somm came in, we played with Doug.
Yeah.
And that kind of stuff. And when Doug came in, we would take him to Yankee games.
Yeah.
That was what he wanted to do. He didn't give a shit about the gig. He wanted to go to the ball game.
Yeah.
And the Yankees hung out at the Lone Star. And I had become very good friends with Goose Gossage, the relief pitcher, Hall of Famer now. And Goose would call me up and say, look, we got about 20 guys. Can we come down? And we just let them all in, all the Yankees and their
That's
wives
so cool.
and shit, and they'd party.
Yeah.
But I could call him and say, Goose, I got about 20 people. Can we come to the game today?
Yeah.
And he'd say, come on out.
Yeah.
And we'd get to the will call window, and there'd be four tickets from Oscar Gamble and four tickets from Greg Nettles and four
oh,
tickets
awesome.
From Reggie Jackson.
Yeah, yeah. You had to put all those together.
Yeah, and so Doug would go with us, and there'd be 20 of us in the players' wives section right behind the plate, and they flashed on the screen the first time there, welcome to Sir Doug from Texas.
Oh, yeah.
He was out of his mind.
Oh, I love that dude yeah. too, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I loved him so much. What a great
hero. Oh, he was a great guy.
Hero.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so you knew Reggie Jackson, too?
I didn't meet Reggie, no. No, I knew, I met almost everybody else. Tommy John became a pretty good friend, and I met a lot of others, but Reggie was kind of a loner guy.
Where was the Lone Star? Because it was a classic place. Like, how long was it around?
The original Lone Star was there from about 76 to, I want to say, about 84.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then they opened one in the 50s. That was on 13th Street and 5th Avenue. And the rent was going up every year, and finally they opened a second one. And it wasn't quite as successful. Plus, and this is what I've heard, one of the accountants absconded with a bunch of money and kind of caused a fold. But the original Lone Star was in a Schraff's in the building that housed a Schraff's, which was like little old ladies in their little sandwiches and their white gloves kind of place. And it was two stories. You walk in the door, and the stage is right there. There's a little seating section there, but the bar is right across the aisle from the stage. And then next to the stage is stairway up, and then seating in kind of a balcony around looking down on the stage.
Yeah.
But there was whole parts of the place that from which you couldn't see the band at all.
Yeah.
Nobody gave a shit. They didn't care. It was the aura. It was Texas. It was. We became actually an official embassy of Texas. We had the paperwork and everything. So when Texans came in, you know, we knew.
Yeah, yeah.
It
seems like there's a couple of places that are almost kind of like that now, just vibe-wise. There's a place called Rockwood.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Music Hall, that guy's from here.
Yeah.
And almost Paul, every time I'm up there.
Talking about Paulo Vici?
No. He ran Zierzamine up
that's
there.
That's right, right, right.
But he actually booked the Hill Country Barbecue.
Right, yeah.
Those guys.
Yeah. Mary and I played that joint.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, we did a duet up there.
That's a great
yeah.
place, right?
Well, we had to play in the window, you know, because normally what they did
in
at
the
that
window,
time.
Was, not downstairs in the kitchen?
No, well, what they did is a band would do a few songs acoustic or like a small set in the window and then go down and play a full set.
Oh.
And we said, we don't want to play the full set. We just pay us a little money. We'll play in the window and get the fuck out of Dodge. And they let us do it. And that's all. We just needed the cash to pay for that night in New York City, basically.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
And we were vegetarians at the time, so the smell was
so
a little hard
really,
to take.
You know what happened, Cleve? I just played there in June, and I played two nights,
yeah.
and I was a little... I didn't eat enough, and being in that place, that's not the place you want to be if you're feeling remotely. I was feeling nauseous before I went in there. Had nothing to do with the place. I love the place.
Yeah.
And the Glossermans, the owner, amazing people. And I went in there feeling nauseous, and that is just not a good place to be.
Yeah.
And you don't, even downstairs.
I totally understand. Yeah. I totally understand. And I'm glad that Jessie's still there. Jessie's doing a good job, and she's bringing people in, you know, Jessie Scott.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've known her since the days of the Lone Star. She was at WHN Radio at that time.
Oh, really?
And she would MC our live broadcasts.
Wow.
And we had people like George Strait, unknown to the world.
Wow.
You know.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a question. When you had like Belushi was coming in, was he on Saturday Night Live?
Oh yeah, and they were just starting the Blues Brothers, and the Blues Brothers band rehearsed there.
Oh, that's killer.
And it was.
Did you ever go to their bar?
Yeah, on Dominic Street, sure did.
I just read this book about Saturday
Night
Live.
Yeah, yeah, we brought the beer. We took the beer.
Oh, you know what? I think that they do talk about, maybe I just read that, the Lone Star Cafe in there, too.
Yeah, they didn't have any beer over there. They didn't have any booze.
Didn't have
at
anything.
All. No.
And
we'd get a call, hey, we're going over to the bar. Can you bring a couple of cases? And we'd bring the beer and then jam until
How
about
exciting.
Noon the next day. And yeah, that was pretty cool.
How exciting, man. Yeah. Who did you see? Because they, I mean, who did you see jam there? And who got on
I
stage?
I jammed there.
You jammed there.
Yeah, actually, there were Dan Aykroyd's brother, Peter, was jamming one night.
Yeah, my friend Einar did demos in LA.
I had taken my slide over, and I got a hot one going. I did real hot on it, and which never happened at the bar. People actually applauded because, you know, it was a party. Nobody ever applauded. You were just jamming.
Yeah, yeah.
But they did, and that pissed Peter off. he wouldn't let me play anymore.
There were guys like, you know, Keith Richards would be up there.
Oh,
would
yeah,
those guys
yeah.
come down to the Lone Star, too? Like,
yeah, we had
they were cool guys?
Keith Richards was at the Lone Star jamming with Etta James the night John Lennon was killed.
Wow.
And we all got the news together. And it was crazy. It was crazy. But he would come in with an entourage of crazies, you know, leading in front of them, you know, Keith's coming.
Yeah.
But when Mick came in, he walked in alone. He paid a cover charge. He was just like a regular guy. We were stunned. We couldn't believe it.
Yeah. That's weird.
Everybody came to the Lone Star.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Did you get to jam with any of those guys during that time?
Every now and then I jammed with some people. I jammed with Johnny Shines and Robert Jr. Lockwood because they were doing Robert Johnson stuff. Uh-huh. I did some of that. My favorite time was, I shouldn't tell this, he's dead, but I'm going to tell him anyway. Nick Gravenites came in with a band, including John Cipollino on guitar.
Oh, wow.
And John, I don't know what the story was, but he was just terrible. He was just playing shit. He was trying to play slide, and I was just getting pissed off. I mean, like, you know, I had to work all night for two nights with it. And I went up to Nick, and I just said, hey, dude, can I jam with you guys?
Yeah.
And I got up, and I tore one. I just tore one with him. Just because if you're going to play slide, this is how you fucking play it.
Yeah.
And Nick asked me if I wanted a tour. I said no.
No.
No. No, I don't.
So when did you leave New York? Or when did, what, like...
We left in...
What did you do then until the Greasy Wheels got back together?
We ran the Lone Star, and then I went over to the Blue Note.
Oh, okay.
And
wow.
managed the Blue Note. And that was a great, great gig for a couple of years, because all the great stars were still alive. Dizzy Gillespie was in all the time, and Sarah Vaughan played through. Everybody from Oscar Peterson on. It was just an amazing time. Herbie Mann was still around. And did that for a while and helped promote some younger guys in the jazz world that hadn't. Jaco Pastorius, I got them to book him. And do you know who Jaco
was? Yeah, of course.
And Jaco was really going through a hard time. He was doing a lot of blow and really out of it. But he was so good and so, I mean, it was so exciting when he played.
Yeah.
He would play for, you know, everybody has 6 days at a jazz club, basically. You do six nights.
Right, right.
And he wouldn't sleep from the first night on. So by the weekend, he would be out. No, no, it would be, that's when it would really get good. And he had all these incredible players, you know, Hiram Bullock and all these, just, But he was so hard to deal with, you know. And Bobby McFerrin came up through there, and it was a good time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then
we came back here. Mostly to be with my children who'd moved back from New York,
okay,
with my ex-wife. And there was no real motive to start the band again because my sister wasn't here. And it has to be Lissa and Mary and me, or it's just not it. So we did clubs. That's when I started working at Steamboat. Not too long after we got here, I did that for, I guess, 4 years.
What years did you work there?
I think I want to say like 85 to 88. Something like that.
Wow. Did you work there when the whole thing? Do you know who my mom was?
Oh yes, I do. Yeah, and Susan Otten was a member of our band at that time.
Oh really?
We did put together a thing called St. Greasy's Wheel, with a couple of old greasers in it.
Yeah, that's a pretty funny name.
I thought it worked pretty good for what we were doing. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
And Susan sang backups with us, and yeah, I was aware of that, all of that.
Yeah.
And I'm still following the Dennis Davis story, as a matter of fact.
It still goes on. It's like the fucking never-ending story.
Yeah, yeah.
There's nothing really else I can say.
Yeah, I don't...
Except for that.
I don't care to comment either,
yeah.
I guess.
Look,
But that was the same time period.
Yeah, and Lorraine was there.
Lorraine and Hank, but they were being pushed out by Craig Hillis.
Right.
Who eventually turned it over to Danny.
Oh, yeah.
From that point, it was going from club management to artist management, and I started agenting for Chris Duarte... and Luann, and Kinky again.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with Tony Price for a while, and the Killer Bees, and, you know, mostly agenting.
Yeah.
Just, you know, you always think if you can stay close to the music, you're in the music. And for maybe a decade and a half, I convinced myself that was the truth, and that's just not the truth. And when Mary got breast cancer in 2000, the decision was made, fuck this, everything is irrelevant. I'm going to start writing again, and we're going to start playing again. And we've never regretted it.
Good.
Yeah.
And she's good?
She's good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Gone Greasy? Is that, yeah, that's the one that kind of, like, got a lot of critical acclaim.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people like that one. I'm surprised that Kitty Cat Jesus didn't get it. The same people.
I really like Kitty Cat Jesus a lot.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. To me, it was, as I said, it was a transition into Brad Houser and Matt Hubbard joining the band. They're on a couple of things on that. But we were also, I think being on hiatus for 23 years sort of put my muse on hold without killing it. So that when I got back to writing, I'm still writing like a mid-30s-year-old guy.
Yeah.
And still, that's still the sensibility with which I approach it.
There's a lot of irreverence in your writing.
Yeah.
I'm very attracted to you.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I love that.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's a lot of middle finger that goes on with your...
That, yeah, and that's an absolute fact, Jack. That's, yeah. And
it's very cool.
Thank you.
Which, once again, there's no, like, 60-year-old dudes now.
No.
Nothing like six. There was no 60-year-old dude doing that kind of stuff. Well, maybe there were probably a couple, but they were probably heralded as nuts.
Well, they were probably doing heroin by then, playing jazz music, unfortunately, something like that. No, you know, a lot of the old ones from that era still kicked pretty good. James Cotton can still bust a move pretty good.
Yeah.
He was a regular at the Lone Star.
Yeah.
And BB's not doing so good, but hey, I'm going to play until it drops.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, you seem to be in good shape. You sound great.
Go to the gym every day.
You're making records. You do? What do you do?
We do cardio every day, and I do weight training, strength training 3 to 4 days a week.
And you feel good?
Well, I've got osteoporosis, and I have back pain, but that was from some steroid stuff that I had to take for a number of years that we lived through it.
Yeah.
You're going to find out as you get into your 60s that even as good as you take care of yourself.
Yeah. Start falling apart.
That's it. The way it works.
Shit breaks down.
You know how I started working out? It was, I wrote a piece for Texas Monthly called Call Me Clevio, where I entered the Mr. Romance cover model pageant in Fort Worth. And that was, they were looking for the next Fabio, okay? So I entered the pageant just to write a story about it. And I started training with Big Steve when he had Big Steve's gym over there. Yeah. And I trained for about 2 months, so I didn't get into any kind of shape. And I won Mr. Congeniality, you know. But it was a funny story, and it addicted me to working out and staying in shape.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's important, man.
I think so.
It is. Yeah. I just quit smoking.
Is that like Friday. A smoking? That's your vape there, yeah.
Here, yeah. This thing, yeah. Well, it's not the same.
Well, yeah, work your way down from that. I quit smoking 8 years ago. I mean, I would go to the gym and light a cigarette for years after I got out of the gym.
I'd go run 4 miles and smoke a cigarette after I cool down.
That's exactly what I was doing.
Because to me, I was doing I'm living in a balanced world.
Yeah, and that's exactly how I played it too. But then that 2006 campaign with Kinky almost killed me. I literally had a physical collapse. My heart was skipping beats and smoking was fucking me up. So I quit.
Yeah.
And never regretted it. And God bless that you were able to do so.
Yeah, this is like the fifth time that I quit.
But this was the third time for me.
It was the easiest time so far.
What I did was I just cut down the number of cigarettes a day down to 13 first. Then I cut them down to 8 so that I could get used to periods where, no, you can't have a cigarette now.
Yeah.
And then I just stopped. My kids bought me a $20 pack of Nicorette gum, and I had one piece, and that was it. I couldn't stand it, and I didn't want to smoke anymore.
Yeah. I don't want to be a slave to anything. That's the other thing, too.
That's exactly it. That's why I won't take a lot of pain pills for my back either. I just, I'm not going to be a slave to those drugs either.
Are there ways that you can get through it?
Well, I'm starting back into physical therapy this week, but it turns out I have what's called an annular fissure. Our bones have little skin around them. It's a little skin that covers all the bones, and there's a tear along my spine in one of those skins. So it's definitely curable, and we just have to find the right motions.
Good. You know. Yeah, because sometimes when people can't figure something like that out, I'm like, there's like a fucking robot that like vacuums your house, and you can't figure that out. Like,
right.
You need that.
Yeah, I finally went the full route and said, give me an MRI, give me everything I need, tell me what I've got exactly, and then let's. I trust doctors to a certain point, but they're not you.
No.
You know, I trust physical therapists to a certain point, but they're not you either. Right. So you got to make your own choices on that.
Yeah. You guys have a show coming up Sunday, November 30th at 8 p.m. at the 1-to-1 bar.
Thank you.
I will come to that show.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good.
I'm excited.
Cool.
I love the people you play with. Love Penny Joe.
Oh, yeah. She's great.
Yeah.
She was the first one to have come. She's been with the band longer than any other Greasy Wheel outside Alyssa, Mary, and myself now.
Right. 13 years.
Yeah. She's been great.
Yeah.
I was the first person she met in Austin.
Really?
When she came
back. She told me that on the show. Yeah. Cleve Hattersley. You're an interesting guy, man.
I'm
I like
fucking
you.
Ubiquitous, man.
You can find out all kinds of stuff about the Greasy Wheels at greasywheels.com.
Thank you.
How did you come up with that name way back then? People used to say things were greasy in the 70s, didn't they?
No, this is way before 70s.
Before that?
I was... In the fifth grade, I was a little chubby kid with long, long legs, but really kind of a chubby, fat body. And I was a fifth grader on the sixth grade basketball team because that was always I could play basketball. And one day I was running down the court, and the way I would run is the legs would turn, 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 and the body would kind of lope, lope, lope. And this guy said, "Hey, look at those greasy wheels." And it was like a thunderburst, the coolest name I'd ever been called.
That's really cool.
I remembered it years later when I got together with our original guitar and bassist, Pat and Mike, and I said, "We got to be Greasy Wheels." And they said, "That's it."
Yeah.
And they chose the spelling. They said, "It's got to be E-E-Z-Y." So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You guys are in the Texas Music Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that's an honor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was there that night. I was.
Cool.
I ran into Penny Joe. But we met, you said, at Steamboat back in the era of Danny.
Yeah, right before Danny came in and started booking some things before he actually took over. So he was in there. But I just remember meeting you when I went back in to hang out with him.
You'd be there downstairs.
Just downstairs. Yeah. Or something. Yeah, like that. Yeah. which had been my domain, and then it was his domain.
Yeah. I guess you couldn't really podcast from there. It wouldn't be right, but
yeah,
boy, that would, some of those walls, you know, could talk just from all the years, you know.
We had developed, or started developing, when Hillis still owned it, Craig Hillis, the upstairs. There's this whole second floor, and there was a time up there when there were two rooms up there that had the best air conditioning in the whole place. So they became a secondary performance room in the back where the windows were. Mm-hmm. And then like this cool manager's lounge.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And those were fun times when like iTechs would come in with all their pot, you know.
Yeah. Who all played there then? Did Stevie play there? Because I know he record something there.
I think he did. He played there in the early days. Everybody did. Hank knew everybody then. So everybody played there at least. And there was another Steamboat up where Dallas is, up on Burnett Road.
Right.
That was Steamboat North.
Yeah. I first went there, I guess maybe you might have been in New York during that time, but Mark, you know Mark Holman?
Oh, yeah, sure.
He released an album, like an EP with Eliza Gilkison.
Yeah.
Like one was on one side and the other one was on the other side.
Ah.
I guess it was like 1982. That was,
yeah,
the
I would
first
have been up there. I would have missed
there.
All of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a cool place.
It had its thing.
A lot of gravity for me on a lot of levels.
Yeah.
Like from that Holman thing, because I was like 14 when I got to go, I got to get out of school and shit. And go up there and like hang out with like Mark Andes and like these like rock stars, you know.
Yeah.
And really get like an education that I should have been getting. And then like all the stuff that, you know, once we did move here and my mom would hang out there, and, you know, it's one of the last place that she went. And then like coming back and getting a residency there and all that stuff. It holds a lot of weight in my...
Nexuses are formed,
yeah.
You know, and you find that you... I've been... A friend of ours that we hadn't seen in about 35 years came through town, and it was just a fond gathering, because there are certain time periods in your life that stand out no matter. Every person has them. It's a formative thing happens or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And my Haight Street time and our time in New York, that's only so many years out of a total lifetime.
Yeah.
But how they impact your lifetime is what counts.
Yeah.
And Steamboat affected a lot of people like that.
Really did.
Really did.
Yeah, it was a very...
I wish Danny could survive it.
Yeah.
I love Danny, but, you know, Steamboat's not going to happen anymore. And
no.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. I'm getting together with that band, Mr. Rockabilly.
I saw that. Yeah. I'm going to try to make that one.
Oh,
I don't
good.
Make a lot of shows. Really, it's very hard to do these days. Mary's Fiddle School is our primary income. So.
Well, that's fantastic, though.
Yeah, yeah.
It's good to be able to have, you know, to diversify. And it seems like you've always been diversifying from tons of weed to New York. To
I did a column for We Magazine.
You did?
For 2 years.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
You know, OUI, the men's magazine?
Yeah, yeah. That was an offshoot of Penthouse.
Yeah, it was. Only by the time I got there, it was really low rent. And I had to fight to keep my column was called The Idiot and the Odyssey. And I had to fight to keep it opposite pages with cock shots, basically. But they let me do anything I wanted. It was really cool, man. And, you know, I went bow hunting with Ted Nugent.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, we went bow hunting.
What was that like? Boy, that's two different political ideologies.
Yeah.
Was it just two guys bow hunting?
Well, it was about six of us out there, but it was his trip. He was out hunting his family meat. He was hunting feral hog in Abilene. And I happened to know the guy out there that connected us in Duarte. Duarte did a tour with Ted,
right.
Which really helped us sell a lot of records.
Yeah.
Duarte hated the tour, but it sold a lot of records. I did a story about taking a team of chemical weapons inspectors into that government pot farm I mentioned.
Oh, wow.
I tried to join Scientology for a day. I went to Las Vegas. I went to Las Vegas to find the soul of Las Vegas.
Oh God! Wait a minute! Stop!
I tried to find the soul of
Las Vegas. What happened? Wait! Because I have a huge thing with that.
The soul of Las Vegas. Yeah. I found it in a Willie Nelson show. Willie was playing the Orleans Club, and that was the closest thing I could find to a beating heart.
That's good.
Yeah. So, I think diversification in life is just sort of a natural thing. You've got to have an outlet.
Yeah.
You're doing this.
Yeah.
This is good stuff, man. And everybody I know has heard your show but me.
Oh. Well, see, that's good. You came in with a clean slate. I don't like it. I don't like it when my guests are aware.
Well, I had no idea what the fuck we were going to do.
This
I like
is what
that
we do.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I like that on a show, too. I like that in tightness and looseness in structure in a band.
Yeah.
Let's
we're jamming.
That's right.
I've got a little bit of an... I mean, there's a lot of stuff in your life, so my notes... I mean, but they're not. They're just names of records and dates. But Sunday, November 30th, 8 p.m., 1 to 1 bar.
Yeah.
Easy Wheels will be playing.
Yeah,
complete
please.
Band.
Yeah. Yeah.
Complete,
please come.
Yeah.
Sexually.
Everyone come. Sexually. That's a good place. Do you like the 1 to 1 bar?
Yeah, it's okay. I think my favorite right now... I don't want to... bet against anybody, but
no.
Right now I'm really liking Strange Brew.
Oh yeah,
I think it's a good
great
room
place.
It feels really nice in there.
Yeah,
and the sound is good. We did the show there a couple weeks ago, and I think we got some good. We've been tracking all of our live shows now again. That's
yeah, that
part
place
of this.
You get a good recording.
Yeah, we got two on the next record that we did out at the Bugle Boy.
Oh really?
It was a very unusual thing where Brad had a gig in Bali, cancel at the last minute after we'd already brought in John Jordan to cover. Our last bassist. So I told Brad, just bring your horn.
Yeah.
And he brought his sax. And we just said, play what you want. And I'm telling you, it was fucking magic on these cuts.
I've seen when he does that, yeah. And it's
fucking magic. The whole thing just sort of exploded. It's almost jazz going on there.
I'd love
it's
to hear
so
that.
So cool. Yeah.
It's going to be on the new album?
It'll be on the new record.
Good.
And also there's a cut, another live cut, where Matt takes off.
Yeah.
Just awesome.
He can really take off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So people go out to the 1 to 1 bar. Sunday.
Johnny will be there. Come.
I will be there. Come. Sexually.
Right.
And I'll be hanging out there. That's going to be a great week. It's Thanksgiving weekend. What the hell else are you going to do on that Sunday?
That's
Maybe
what
your
I'm
family
thinking.
Be out of town.
That's what I'm thinking. John Bush is going to be playing right in front of us too.
Oh really?
Yeah. John's
going
to do his show.
Oh
right
yeah,
in
the
front.
John Bush. I played with them.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's
he
a
mentioned
lot of fun.
That. Yeah, yeah.
Well, Cleve, I look forward to seeing you. I've got your number now, so don't freak out if I start texting you and asking you to do stuff.
Oh, absolutely. Delighted to do so, and thanks for having me, man.
Good, man. Thank you.
Much appreciated.
Hey, 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 hey.
All right. Cleve Hattersley, what an interesting guy. I loved that conversation. Definitely one of the top 10. Of all time for me so far. Cleve Hattersley, fantastic guy. I want to thank my friend Jason Swedberg for hooking that up. And Greasy Wheels, amazing band. You can find out more about them at greasywheels.com. And if you are in Austin this Sunday, November 30th, they will be playing at the 1 to 1 bar at 8 p.m. I will be there to see them. Cleve, Lissa, Sweet Mary Hattersley, John Bush, Brad Hauser, Penny Joe Pullis, Matt Hubbard, Greasy Wheels. Sunday, November 30th, 2014, 8 p.m., 1 to 1 bar. I want to thank Cleve once again for coming by. Thank you, Cleve. And look, while you're out there on the internet finding out about the Greasy Wheels and buying their albums and stuff, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can also find us on Stitcher, which is an app that's available on your phone. It's for free. It streams many, many podcasts, over 5,000 shows, including great NPR shows that you love and even audio versions of like 60 Minutes and stuff like that. You can also like our Facebook page. You can follow me on Instagram and on Twitter. I'm at Johnny Gowdy. I hope that you are all having a great Thanksgiving, okay? Happy, happy Thanksgiving. I want to thank Cleve again for coming by. Let's listen to some Greasy Wheels. Happy Thanksgiving. Let's get down.
I cry myself. Who knew when it I cry myself to sleep.